top stories, Iran's foreign minister is on an official visit to China. He says strategic issues are on the agenda of his talks with Chinese officials. Fresh revelations emerge about parties held at the British Prime Minister's office during last year's COVID lockdown amid calls for Boris Johnson's resignation. North Korea test fires more ballistic missiles hours after it warned of strong reaction in case of new U.S. sanctions. Greetings, everyone, and welcome. Iran's foreign minister, who is on official visit to China, says strategic issues are on the agenda of his talks with the officials there. Hossein Amir Abdullahian explained that the talks cover a range of issues, including international developments as well as political and economic issues. He made the remarks upon arrival in the Chinese city of Wuxi earlier in the day. He said Iran and China have had good cooperation in recent months. He also noted that the two sides have made good progress in different areas in line with their national interests. Amir Abdullahian has already met with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says his administration is putting efforts to remove anti-Iran sanctions high on the agenda. In a tweet, President Raisi said the efforts to neutralize the sanctions are not tied to the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. He said despite the existing sanctions, Iran is selling oil. Raisi said the sales have now increased to the level that no worries are left and revenues are being returned to the country. In separate remarks on Friday, President Raisi said sanctions and threats cannot hinder Iran's progress. He cited the country's military development, saying they have been achieved despite severe restrictions on this sector. The eighth round of negotiations between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal continues in the Austrian capital. Earlier we were joined by our Vienna-based correspondent Huma Lezgi for an update.
Expert-level talks are continuing, and we're hearing from sources close to the Iranian team that the expert-level talks have been focusing on implementation or sequencing. So what steps need to be taken, when, by which side? We know that the working groups have been working on various issues. One is the removal of U.S. sanctions. One is Iran's return to its nuclear commitments, and others focusing on verification and guarantees, the points you just mentioned in the news story. Also, the Russian ambassador, Mr. Ulyanov, when he was asked on Twitter whether there would be any break in this current round, he responded by saying that nobody as of yet has asked for such a break, and they're all focused on the, quote, the difficult talks moving ahead, and they want to make this happen. Of course, you said there that the U.S. Has said that they want to make this restoration take place in a matter of weeks. They have been quite adamant on this issue of timing, both Europeans and the Americans and the EU coordinator themselves. They all have been saying that time is of the essence. Iran saying that it doesn't want to abide by any deadline. I don't think any of the participants want to do that, but they do want to make it happen as soon as possible if they can make this the final round. But of course, what we're hearing is that there are still a lot of technical, legal, and political matters that need further discussions, that need time. Behind the scenes, we're hearing that they still need more time to be able to find ways to give the verification that Iran needs, to get the guarantees that Iran needs to, in a way that would be acceptable for both parties, both the Americans and the Iranians.
Another blow to Boris Johnson's shaky premiership. Fresh reports say staff at the British Prime Minister's office partied on the eve of the socially distanced funeral of the Queen's husband, Prince Philip. The UK-based Daily Telegraph says number 10 staff gathered on April the 16th of last year for two separate leaving events. One was for James Slack, the Prime Minister's departing director of communications. Another was for a personal photographer of Johnson. The events took place the day before Prince Philip was laid to rest. At that time, social gatherings were banned across the UK as part of COVID restrictions. Johnson himself was absent at those parties, but he is already facing calls to resign over several more parties held at Downing Street during lockdowns. Critics, including those from Labour, say Johnson is unfit to head the government and cannot be trusted. The British Queen's second son, Prince Andrew, is stripped of his royal and military titles as he faces a U.S. civil case for sexual assault. According to British media, Prince Andrew will no longer be entitled to enjoy His Royal Highness title. The Buckingham Palace has also said the prince has given up his honorary military titles and charitable roles. That comes after more than 150 British veterans wrote to Queen Elizabeth calling on her to strip Andrew of his ranks and titles in the armed forces. The Duke of York is facing public outrage over his sexual misconduct. He denies any wrongdoing, but on Wednesday, a U.S. federal judge rejected an appeal over allegations that Andrew sexually assaulted a woman when she was 17. Virginia Giuffre accuses Andrew of assaulting her in 2001. 5 months into an energy crisis in the UK, a controversial blog post by one of the country's major energy suppliers has prompted a wave of outrage. It comes as average households face a sharp rise in their energy bills starting in spring, coupled with rising taxes and stalling wages. Our London correspondent Saipuraza has more.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer. Do star jumps or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mould, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse, so...
It's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring. Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saipuraza, London.
After a short respite due to the coronavirus, a new report shows that the situation of asylum seekers on the western edge of Europe has become worse than ever. It comes on the heels of a manslaughter lawsuit against the Coast Guards of the United Kingdom and France, following the deadliest mass drowning on record in the English Channel late last year. Ramin Mazahiri has more.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran keeps reporting low numbers of COVID-related fatalities as the country presses ahead with its vaccination campaign. Health officials registered 24 new deaths in the past day, raising the country's overall toll to more than 132,000. Also, over 2,500 new daily cases were detected in the same period. On average, COVID-related figures have been on a downward trend owing to the country's intense vaccination program. Days ago, the health ministry called on Iranians to get booster shots in addition to observing health protocols. Iranian authorities say nearly 80% of the country's population has received two COVID jabs. In East Asia now, South Korea and Japan say the North has conducted a new weapons test, firing projectiles eastward. The two countries say North Korea used two short-range ballistic missiles in the latest test. Pyongyang has already carried out two tests of what it called hypersonic missiles in the past weeks. Following that, the U.S. imposed sanctions on five people linked to North Korea's ballistic weapons program.
Earlier this month, in his New Year message, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said North Korea would continue to bolster its military capabilities because the peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. And now Kim seems determined to fulfill that pledge. This week he oversaw a hypersonic missile test. North Korean media said the projectile launched on Tuesday successfully made a turn before destroying its target 1,000 kilometers away. It was North Korea's third test of such a missile. South Korea's military acknowledged that the latest missile launch demonstrated quote-unquote improvement from previous tests. The North seems resolute on its path to master the new technology. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes, making them less vulnerable to interception. The main feature of hypersonic weapons is their maneuverability, which makes them much harder to detect by radar. North Korea is now undoubtedly among a small number of countries, including the United States, racing to develop hypersonic weapons. The United States and some of its allies were quick to condemn the North's latest test. The U.S. did not stop there. It later announced sanctions against a number of individuals for their alleged roles in producing goods for Pyongyang's weapons program.
The United States Department of the Treasury imposed sanctions against six North Koreans, one Russian and a Russian company on Wednesday. It accused them of buying goods for North Korea's weapons program from Russia and China. To what extent can such measures hamper the North's efforts to advance its defense program?
The U.S. administration said the measures are aimed at preventing the advancement of North Korea's military programs and to block its attempts to develop weapons technologies. The sanctions imposed by the U.S. Treasury freeze all U.S. assets of those who are targeted and generally bans Americans from doing any business with them. Can such measures put obstacles in the way of North Korea's development of advanced weapons? Past experience shows that's highly unlikely because Pyongyang has been subjected to Western sanctions for many years. It has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
Those sanctions continue to implement not just food, but also medicine, technology, equipment to make life impossible for the people of the DPRK, just as they're doing in Iran, just as they're doing in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. But I think that these sanctions are not going to have much of an effect any longer, because we have to remember that the era of U.S. dominance, of the single dominance hegemony of the U.S. is over.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The North seems to deeply distrust America. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden insists that it is open to dialogue with North Korea. But Pyongyang seems to have learned a lesson from Trump's era and his futile attempts at detente.
I think the Biden administration, while in appearance it may seem that it's more progressive or more prone to dialogue, in reality it is very much achieving the same goals as Trump and the Republican strategy in general against the DPRK, which is regime change.
Pyongyang has described American diplomatic overtures as empty rhetoric without meaningful changes to hostile policies, including war games close to its borders and economic sanctions. The latest American sanctions are expected to further complicate the situation.
And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has dropped at least 337,000 bombs and missiles in 20 years. Stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Miria Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis, activist. This article is published under the heading, The U.S. Drops an Average of 46 Bombs a Day. Why should world see Americans as a force for peace? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Pentagon has finally published its first air power summary since Biden took office nearly a year ago. These monthly reports have been published since 2007 to document the number of bombs and missiles dropped by U.S.-led air forces in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria since 2004. But President Trump stopped publishing them after February 2020. Shrouding continued U.S. bombing in secrecy. Over the past 20 years, as documented in the report, U.S. and allied air forces have dropped more than 337,000 bombs and missiles on other countries. That's an average of 46 strikes per day for 20 years. This endless bombardment has not only been deadly and devastating for its victims, but is broadly recognized as seriously undermining international peace and security and diminishing America's standing in the world. The U.S. regime and political establishment have been remarkably successful at keeping the American public in the dark about the horrific consequences of these long-term campaigns of mass destruction, allowing them to maintain the illusion of U.S. militarism as a force for good in the world in their domestic political rhetoric. The new air power summary data revealed that the United States has dropped another 3,246 bombs and missiles on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria since February 2020. The good news is that U.S. bombing of those three countries has significantly decreased from the over 12,000 bombs and missiles it dropped on them in 2019. In fact, since the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Afghanistan in August, the U.S. military has officially conducted no air strikes there and only dropped 13 bombs and missiles on Iraq and Syria, although this does not preclude additional unreported strikes by forces under CIA command or control. And there has been no accountability for these 20 years of senseless destruction. Even with the publication of air power summaries, the ugly reality of U.S. bombing wars and the mass casualties they inflict remain largely hidden from the American people. How many of the 3,246 attacks documented in the air power summary since February 2020 were you aware of before reading its article? You probably heard about the drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians in Kabul in August 2021. But what about the other 3,245 bombs and missiles? Whom did they kill or maim, and whose homes did they destroy? The December 2021 New York Times expose of the consequences of U.S. airstrikes, the result of a five-year investigation, was stunning not only for the high civilian casualties and military lies it exposed, but also because it revealed just how little investigative reporting the U.S. media have done on these two decades of war. In America's industrialized remote control air wars, even the U.S. military personnel most directly and intimately involved are shielded from human contact with the people whose lives they are destroying. While for most of the American public, it is as if these hundreds of thousands of deadly explosions never even happened. The lack of public awareness of U.S. airstrikes is not the result of a lack of concern for the mass destruction the U.S. regime commits in their names. In rare cases, we find out about, like the murderous drone strike in Kabul in August, the public wants to know what happened and strongly supports U.S. accountability for civilian deaths. So, public ignorance of 99% of U.S. airstrikes and their consequences is not the result of public apathy, but of deliberate decisions by the U.S. military, politicians of both parties, and corporate media to keep the public in dark. The largely unremarked 21-month-long suppression of monthly air power summaries is only the latest example of this. These figures are based on U.S. air power summaries for Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism's count of drone strikes in Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen. The Yemen Data Project's count of bombs and missiles dropped on Yemen, though September 2021. The New America Foundation's database of foreign airstrikes in Libya and other sources. There are several categories of airstrikes that are not included in the table, meaning that the true numbers of weapons unleashed are certainly higher. Air power summaries from 2004 to 2007 included a note that their tally of strikes with munitions dropped does not include 20mm and 30mm cannon or rockets. But the 30mm cannons on A-10 Warfox and other ground attack planes are powerful weapons originally designed to destroy Soviet tanks. A-10S can fire 65 depleted uranium shells per second to blanket an area with deadly and indiscriminate fire, but that does not appear to count as a weapons release in air power summaries. Counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations in other parts of the world, the U.S. formed a military coalition with 11 West African countries in 2005 and has built a drone base in Niger. But we have not found any systematic accounting of U.S. and allied airstrikes in that region or in the Philippines, Latin America, or elsewhere. The failure of the U.S. government, politicians, and corporate media to inform and educate the American public about the systematic mass destruction wreaked by their country's armed forces has allowed this carnage to continue largely unremarked and unchecked for 20 years.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Sheikh Kazem Ali.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani laynur rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa bihi nasta'in. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. I welcome you all to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program For Humanity, and our topic is Hollywood conditioning of the subconscious mind and the extermination of the human right. This is the second episode, and let's talk about some of the experiments that they have conducted to control the human beings and to control the subconscious mind of the human beings and to trample the human rights without we realizing that our human rights are being compromised or exterminated. Let me mention about Ivan Pavlov, a Russian doctor who was conducting experiments on a dog. He was conducting an experiment to see how does dog react to certain type of foods and how does the digestive system of the dog react to certain foods. And then he noticed that every time he would bring the food and serve it to the dog would start salivating. And after a couple of times, he realized that even before he would give the food to the dog or present the food to the dog would start salivating just by hearing the footsteps of him coming towards the dog or hearing the sound of him mixing his food in the bowl, and that would make the dog salivate. And this made him curious. So what he did was he said, let me conduct a small experiment here. So he put a green light there and he put a bell there. And every time he served food to the dog, he would turn on the light and ring the bell. And now there is an external information. What we call it in psychological term is external stimuli. So there is an external information that is being associated with food while the food is being served to the dog. So the brain of the dog registers two things here. One, food. To the external information, which is the light and the bell. And subsequently, what Ivan Pavlov did was slowly he started turning on the light, ringing the bell, and delaying the serving of the food. So he started delaying the food by 30 seconds, then by 1 minute, then by 2 minutes, then by 5 minutes. Then he noticed that every time he would turn the light on, ring the bell, the dog would start salivating irrespective of food being there or not being there. That means Ivan Pavlov managed to condition the subconscious mind of the dog with the help of a light and a bulb, where he would turn on the light, turn on the bulb, and then food the serve 1 hour later. And all this while, in that duration where the light is turned on and the bell keeps ringing every 5 minutes, the dog continues to salivate for 1 whole hour. And this is where they discovered how to condition the subconscious mind and control the involuntary actions of animals. Now, the question that they had in front of them, the question that they were faced with was, can this be done with the human beings too? And then they slowly started experimenting upon human beings using various techniques that we will subsequently discuss in our set of episodes that are going to come, right from choosing the kind of music, choosing the kind of images, choosing the kind of dialogues and the words that they use in their animation series, in their movies, in their music, in their songs, and even the nursery rhymes that they make for the children.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Let me also mention another case study here, where they conducted a case study to see the impact of personalities, impact of people on decision making or the choices. So they had a case study where they saw that a person who had committed a heinous crime, a person who had committed a murder was brought to the court, and this person was a colored person. So now the judges were asked to give sentence to this colored person, though it was proven in the court that this person is innocent. Most of the evidences pointed towards the point that this person is innocent. The chair, the group of judges that were there, they said a person that looks like this, the person who is dark colored, the person whose facial structure is like this, it is far to think that such a person would be innocent, and they gave him a death sentence. On the other hand, a very beautiful lady was brought to the court, and she had actually committed the crime, and all the evidences pointed towards her, but the chair, that is the judge, and the council of the judges that were sitting there, they, when they were asked to pass the judgment, they look at the girl. She was a beautiful looking blonde girl. They said a good looking, a beautiful looking blonde girl like this would definitely have a kind heart, and even though all the evidences point towards her committing the crime, let's not be very stringent on her punishment. And then they gave her a very, very lenient punishment. And this case studies went into the psychological discussions and books related to psychology. And this is where they realized that how the looks of a person, how the color of the person influences the decision and the choices that we make. And that's why you will see that in most of the movies, most of the advertisements, most of the cartoons, most of the animation series, they use good looking, beautiful looking women with blonde hair or makeup so that they can influence our choice, they can influence our decision making, they can influence our conscious mind, they can influence our subconscious mind, and hence controlling our subconscious mind. Again, let me point this back to you, that a lot of people might say, what's wrong with that? The problem is that one of the fundamental element of human rights is the right to choose. And while we say that this is a free right, you are free to choose whatever you want to choose, and then from the other hand, they condition your subconscious mind, they condition your conscious mind, they force you to choose something that you're not willing to choose or not understanding whether it's beneficial for you or not. This is what is going to point to us that it is against the human rights to condition someone to choose which is beneficial for them instead of being beneficial for the user or for ourselves. Let's continue this in our next episode. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ahli baytihi tayyibin at-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the Prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair, and grieved in his heart were the words of his Lord. To all of mankind, this was his call. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify Allah. Bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is his messenger.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The physical closing of Guantanamo cannot be used as a way of erasing its terrible legacy of harm. There must follow a reckoning with the collective moral failure of the U.S. it represents, says Mahal Hilal writer in an article titled Guantanamo, Why Biden, Just Like Trump, Cannot Close This Brutal Prison. Stay tuned for more. For the last two decades, the most notorious prison in America has been Guantanamo. We know it today, and we knew it when the Senate Judiciary Committee held its first hearing on closing the detention center at Guantanamo in 2013. These words were delivered by Senator Dick Durbin during the opening statement of a hearing by the committee on December 7th. Though the intention of the hearing was clearly signaled by its title, Closing Guantanamo, Ending 20 Years of Injustice, conclusions remain elusive exactly 20 years after the infamous prison was opened to house prisoners of America's so-called War on Terror. There is still no end in sight. Durbin, one of the most outspoken legislative advocates for closing Guantanamo, argued during the December hearing that keeping the prison open was costly, that it impacted the U.S. reputation, and that it threatened U.S. national security. In a similar vein, one of the military witnesses at the hearing, retired Marine Major General Michael Leonard, asked, "Who gains by keeping Guantanamo open? Not America. Those who would harm us are the ones who gain. They point to the existence of Guantanamo as proof that America is not a nation of laws. They use Guantanamo as a recruiting tool. They do not want us to close Guantanamo," unquote. Just over a month before the hearing, former Guantanamo detainee and torture survivor Majid Khan testified directly about his experience in CIA custody. Khan's testimony was the first of its kind, and it prompted widespread condemnation of his treatment, including by the panel of military jurors overseeing his sentencing. Despite this opportunity to open a dialogue about how to meaningfully address the legacy of torture and brutality at Guantanamo, Durbin's was the only voice to directly acknowledge it, adding that this abuse was of no practical value in terms of intelligence, if any other tangible benefit to U.S. interests. However, it is wrong to torture whether or not useful information is gained by glossing over the brutality prisoners have been subjected to as a fundamental reason for closing Guantanamo. Even staunch critics of the prison legitimized the dehumanization of prisoners that justified building it in the first place. And the oft-repeated narrative that Guantanamo serves as a recruitment tool especially deflects away from the U.S. violent legacy of torture and indefinite detention that has made the prison infamous. 20 years and three prior presidential administrations since Guantanamo Bay Prison opened under the guise of the so-called War on Terror, its closure now rests in Biden's hands, although the Biden administration has signaled its intention is to close Guantanamo. Its actions thus far indicate that they are not prepared to expand political capital to see this goal through. Not only did the administration fail to send a representative to Senator Durbin's hearing, but the president has also signed the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, despite it retaining decade-old restrictions on the use of federal funds for prisoner transfer from Guantanamo that effectively prevent the release of detainees even after they have been cleared through both legal and national security processes. Although Biden criticized the NDAA's Guantanamo provisions in a concurrent statement, his fundamental inaction is symptomatic of how real progress toward closing Guantanamo and reckoning with its brutal legacy is stymied by deep undercurrents of American Islamophobia. These undercurrents influence the debate on both sides in the form of anti-Muslim narratives as well as the erasure of the victims and survivors. Tellingly, during a two-hour-plus-long Senate hearing on the closure of Guantanamo, the prisoner's Muslim identity was only mentioned once. The logic of collective responsibility and punishment applied uniquely to Muslims in the context of the so-called War on Terror, however, formed the backdrop throughout. One way in which the Islamophobic fallacy of collective responsibility is perpetuated is the insistence that the remaining detainees cannot be safely released because of the supposed risk of recidivism. Contributing further to the perpetuation of the narrative of collective responsibility regarding Muslim detention at Guantanamo is the U.S. recent military withdrawal from Afghanistan. Rather than sticking to the government's claim that the war in Afghanistan is now over, suggesting many of the detentions should also end, the aftermath of chaos and violence that the United States regime left behind in that country has been leveraged as yet another reason why Guantanamo should not be closed. During this last hearing, for example, Jamil Jafar, the executive director of the National Security Institute, testified that the threat today is worse specifically because we withdrew from Afghanistan in the way and manner that we did, because terrorist groups see this ungoverned space as an opportunity to once again consolidate their efforts and fight the West. Demonstrating a complete lack of accountability, he suggests the problems that the U.S. left in the war's aftermath should be used to adjudicate whether or not to release prisoners. This position is buttressed by the logic that since some former prisoners have become members of the government, anyone now released from Guantanamo may enlist and challenge the United States. If the prevailing logic of collective responsibility is applied to prisoners as a function of the global reach of the U.S. state violence instead of being based on the merits of each case, then Guantanamo will always remain open and occupied. The Biden administration now has the opportunity to act forthrightly and begin the process of not merely closing Guantanamo, but reckoning with the collective moral failure that it represents. A troubling prospect, though, has been raised by recent media reports suggesting that rather than taking quiet steps to close Guantanamo, as the administration has claimed, the government is in fact actively adding to the detention facility's infrastructure by constructing a new courtroom. This addition would all but ensure that the failures of transparency and judicial principle will continue. The features of the new courtroom echo the extreme secrecy that has characterized previous Guantanamo trials, for example, by leaving no room for observers. perhaps more important than the whims of any particular administration, however, is the fact that after 20 years, we still cannot seem to name the problem when it comes to Guantanamo. Just as the issue of police brutality cannot be solved without addressing the systematic anti-blackness that perpetuates it, Guantanamo must be seen through the lens of Islamophobia, and the context that's made it possible, or closure, will be little more than any empty gesture. We must not let Guantanamo close its doors as a way of erasing the legacy of harm it embodies once again from public view. Instead, the U.S. must grapple seriously with the question of how to end the injustice that has been visited on Muslim prisoners and which goes far beyond abandoning the use of a physical structure.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. As mentioned previously, that a quality that a person contains manifests itself in many different ways. It cannot just be claimed that a person is an alim and then not have certain signs to show that he is an alim. Signs that come about from that, or from that being of a scholar, not that you know he acts or he pretends and he or he does riya and so on and so forth, no. Or she even. There are certain signs that will manifest itself from that person that shows other people, oh, this is a true scholar. Or rather, a person should look for these signs and say, oh no, this is a true scholar. Because of the signs that the Imams have told us that a scholar possesses. Or any other of the other traits. Whether it be generosity, whether it be aestheticism, and so on and so forth. So in this tradition, which is in two parts, and in this we'll just mention the first part, and in our next discussion we'll mention the second part. So in this one, the Imam alayhi salam, that is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, says that from the indicators of a scholar, so very clear, that from those things that indicate that this person is a scholar, is what? That this scholar, when he is criticized, when somebody takes one of his opinions and says, no, this opinion is not right in my opinion because of A, B, C, D. And if those critiques are in place, they are valid, a true scholar will accept it. So a scholar has given a particular opinion, another scholar has come, or even another person has come and has critiqued it. They said, no, this is not correct because of A, B, C, D. A true scholar will say, thank you. Thank you for showing me my flaws, and thank you for enabling me to progress in my knowledge. Why? Because if a person is critiqued, it then forces him, in a good way, to go and find out, why was I wrong? Where can I fix this? Where can I improve on this? This is a true scholar. A scholar is the person who continuously seeks progress. And the only way a person can progress is when critique is done. In the Islamic world, if you really want to see how the knowledge of the Islamic scholars progress, it is because of the critiques of those who even at times were not actually aware of what they were saying. But they critiqued, and it then resulted in the true scholars, those who knew what they were saying, to go and to explain it in a better, in a clearer, and even by doing so, find out new angles and finding out new realms and new answers for that particular question. So this is the first part of the hadith from Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Inshallah, in our next episode we will mention the second part. So just to kind of summarize, the Imam alayhi salam says that from the indicators of a scholar, of an alim, is that he accepts the critiques of others for his sayings and his opinions. So inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.